you will always find that English language Palestinian spokesperson who knows how to speak in sort of campus lingo about Palestinians and drive that agenda and that framing. We are an artificial implant from elsewhere by nefarious outside forces that are very, very powerful. The British Empire, the Tsarist Empire, the German Empire, the American Empire, the French Empire.
And it's always a different imperial project.
Always a different, to the point where in 1948, the Egyptian declaration of war in the Egyptian parliament is a declaration of war against us for being communists.
Shalom, and welcome to State of a Nation. I'm Alon Levy. The October 7th massacre didn't happen in a vacuum. The UN Secretary General set off a firestorm when he said that, as if those atrocities could be rationalized or excused, as if it depended on the context. But he was right. Hamas's attacks didn't happen in a vacuum, and context matters. There are many names for what happened that awful day when Hamas terrorists massacred 1,200 people and took 253 hostages. The October 7 attacks, the Black Saturday, the Simchat Torah massacre. But for Hamas, it has one name: Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Al-Aqsa, the name of the mosque that sits atop the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. It's easy to think that the Arab-Israeli conflict is some kind of real estate dispute. Both the Israelis and Palestinians want the land, and like naughty children, they just can't agree to share it. But this is a conflict about land plus religion, land plus nationalism, land plus history, and that means it's a conflict about narrative. A clash between two epic stories about what we are doing here, what the other side is doing here, how we got here, and where we go from here. And nothing symbolizes that better than Al-Aqsa, the ultimate symbol of Hamas's vision of a religious caliphate from the river to the sea. For the Palestinians, an Islamic holy site that Muslim armies must rise up to liberate from the infidels, the Jews. For Israelis, a mosque that sits on top of the holiest site in Judaism, the Temple Mount, above the rubble of the two ancient Jewish temples, the ultimate reminder that Israel is the Jews' ancestral homeland. This is a conflict about two peoples whose narratives are fundamentally misaligned and yet whose identities are inextricably intertwined. Who, when they're not shouting at each other, are at least talking at cross purposes. What do the Palestinians get fundamentally wrong about us, the Israelis? How are those misunderstandings aggravating this conflict? And is there any way for us and for the world to help our neighbors see us through different eyes and understand, no, we're not foreign colonizers who will disappear if they use enough violence? Israel is our homeland, and we are here to stay. My guest today is the brilliantly pugnacious Haviv Retigor, political correspondent and senior analyst at the Times of Israel. In between making sense of Israel's politics, Haviv has invested deep and nuanced thought into making sense of the Palestinians' narratives about Israel, tracing patterns through history, unpacking how the history of the Holy Land repeats itself, first as tragedy, second as farce, and third as the horrific attacks of October 7th. Join us as we unpack how history is driving stories, how stories are driving history, history that makes the state of our nation.
Breaking news out of Israel this morning.
Shocking hostage taking.
Hundreds of Israelis are dead.
I want to bring in Israeli government spokesman.
What happens when the four-day pause?
How do you resolve this?
Where does this go?
You can't do
this. Haviv, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Alan. How are you?
Haviv, Israel assumed that Hamas would never launch an October 7th style invasion because it knew it would get thumped. And it's getting thumped. And still, polls show that a majority of Palestinians think it was the correct decision for Hamas to launch the October 7th attacks, despite everything that's been happening. What can they see? What do they think they can see that we don't?
There is a shallow answer and a deeper answer. The shallow answer is, well, the shallowest answer is a desire to take as to cause as much damage to Israel as possible, a desire rooted in decades of conflict. But the next level down is that it's a classic guerrilla war. In a guerrilla war, the guerrilla forces attack the enemy, often the enemy's civilians, and then hide behind their own civilians. This is the classic move. We saw this in Vietnam, in Algeria, and just about everywhere where you have a guerrilla war. And guerrilla war has not yet been seen among many Palestinians. Incidentally, in the West Bank, support for the October 7 massacre is much higher than in Gaza.
Because so they're not paying the price for it.
Those who understand the price have a much lower sense of how great an idea it was. Support for Hamas surviving the war is vastly higher in the West Bank than it is among Gazans, where it is not even a plurality. It is something, I forget the exact numbers, between 15 and 20% actually want Hamas to rule Gaza at the day after the war. These are Palestinian pollsters polling Palestinians with the cooperation of international polling firms, very reliable polls. So Gazans do not share that view. But those Palestinians who do share that view think that they're actually engaged in a guerrilla war. But then there's the truly deep level. Societies are always operating on multiple levels. People, ordinary people, think in many different layers. And I think that the deepest layer is how Palestinians see us.
And what is that, sir? Because, you know, for Jews in the land of Israel, we have a very clear story that we tell ourselves about returning home to our ancestral land after 2,000 years. But that's not the story that they're telling about us.
Right. They have a story well over a century in the making, in which the experience of Arabs in this land, when this was still the Ottoman Empire, and the Arab elites here saw themselves as Ottomans, and when they saw the earliest Zionist immigrants in the 1880s and 1890s, their concern was for the Ottoman Empire, not so much for themselves. And they were writing and they wrote letters and they had letters exchanged with the Ottoman government in Constantinople. It wasn't yet called Istanbul. And the main concern they had was a sense that has never really left them, that we are something other than what we feel or claim we are. So, for example, who are the first Zionist immigrants to this land? Who are the first Jews in the modern era to, in any appreciable numbers, come to the land of Israel? The simple answer is they're refugees. They are fleeing the massive uptick in pogroms and massacres of Jews that follows the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. Our story basically is that roughly beginning in about 1880, Europe spends about six decades becoming uninhabitable to Jews. Everybody knows about the Holocaust, but people don't really
forget it was the culmination of a much broader process of...
Exactly, where Jews are kicked out of universities in Romania in 1882. The son of the assassinated Tsar passes what are called the May Laws, anti-Semitic laws that further restrict Jewish lives. And you suddenly see Jews lining up at the Ottoman embassy in Odessa, in present-day Ukraine, Russian-speaking Jews lining up at the embassy to get permission to enter the Ottoman Empire to move to what is then Ottoman Palestine. Not all of it is called Palestine at the time. Some of it is part of the province of Beirut. Anything north of what is today Netanya basically is part of Beirut. But nevertheless, they are lining up to go to the land of Israel. And in the land of Israel, Palestinian Arabs, Arabs of this land, are writing letters talking about those Jews not as refugees fleeing the murderers of those, the pogromists of southern Russia. They talk about us as agents of Tsarist Russia.
The same Tsarist Russia they're fleeing
from.
We
are agents of the Tsar. Now, that is not as silly as it sounds. It is literally the exact opposite of the Jewish experience, but it's not silly if you are them.
Why? It sounds fairly daft to me from the distance of history.
Yes, it sounds ridiculous to us now. It sounded ridiculous to the immigrants then. But if you are an Ottoman, your great archenemy is the Tsarist Russian Empire. The Russian Empire, if we're going to start our Zionist history in 1881, 3 years earlier, a war ended between the Ottomans and the Russians, in which the Russians conquered a significant portion of the Balkans from the Ottomans. It was something like the fourth war in 80 years between the Ottomans and the Russians. The Russians are constantly eating away at the Ottomans. They are the Crimean War is a Russian-Ottoman war. They are the major threat. And there's also a treaty between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and between the Ottoman Empire and most major powers in Europe called the capitulations. The capitulations are a series of treaties the Ottomans sign with Western powers, essentially to bring commerce, Western commerce, into a very impoverished Ottoman Empire. And one of the things that these capitulations does is it gives subjects of these Western powers, Venice, the Austro-Hungarians, the Germans, it gives their subjects immunity to Ottoman law so that traders can come into the Ottoman Empire from Venice, from Vienna, from Moscow. They can trade. They can know they can't be arrested in the Ottoman Empire. And then they can go back. And that is to encourage that trade.
So you're saying this false narrative that the Palestinians would believe in nowadays, and we'll get into what the misconceptions are now, about Israelis as somehow colonialists or agents of imperialism, is in fact a misconception that goes all the way back to 1881 and seeing them as agents of the Tsar.
Because in those 1880s, when the Ottoman authorities tried to arrest one of these Russian subjects, who are refugees fleeing the Tsar and pogroms and death, what they discovered, the Jews appeal to the Russian embassy whenever they can. To get out of, they have some legal recourse, right? Mm. If somebody sues you, you have some legal, you're going to take every legal recourse you
have.
And
they're going to the embassy of the regime from which they fled.
From which they fled. To the Arab experience of that period, there is a case. It looks that way. It smells that way.
Mm.
The fact that it isn't the actual driving force bringing those Jews in is secondary to how it looks on the ground to Arabs living in the land at the time.
And how do you see that pattern then recurring and evolving and morphing and undergoing that metamorphosis until what we have today?
In every generation, there is another explanation for the new wave. When the Zionist Jews are trying to figure out whether the Technion, our greatest technical school today, our MIT in Haifa, but in the 1920s, as it is being established, there's a big debate whether we should teach Hebrew or German at the Technion. Those who say we have to teach in German are pointing out a very simple thing. You cannot speak, you cannot do quantum physics in Hebrew in the 1920s. Hebrew is a rich and evocative language. It's a language more and more being spoken on the streets of this new community, but it nevertheless doesn't know how to do quantum physics. And so we have to speak German in the Technion. Palestinian Arab press, liberated in the 1910s, essentially by the fall of the Ottoman censorship, and so then we really have a real rich discourse on Palestinian in Palestinian media. Palestinian Arab press interprets and talks about that intra-Jewish fight over whether to teach quantum physics in German or real quick develop quantum physics in Hebrew so we can teach in Hebrew.
How did they see that?
As a contest between German imperial identity, affinity, affiliation of these Jews, and because there was such a large Yekki elite among the Jews, or in fact, whether we have this Hebrew nationalism that is trying to express itself. You fast forward to the later 1920s, the San Remo Conference, where the League of Nations convenes and tries to think about, and really begins to seriously propose giving the Jews significant part of the land to found their national home. Say the Palestinians, we weren't there. We were not invited to the San Remo Conference. So it looks like Western imperialism to us.
Mm.
You fast forward to British control, which begins in World War I when the British take the land from the Ottomans. It begins in 1917. The mandate is instituted in the early 20s. And right up until 1939, the British Empire officially supports Zionism and supports the Zionist cause. And so they begin to think that that Zionism is, in fact, the long arm of British imperialism.
And that, in a nutshell, really is the core misconception you're saying about how the Palestinians fail to understand us, that essentially they are... How do we fit in their minds?
We are always the long arm of something else.
And it's always a different imperial project.
Always
in each generation.
Different, to the point where in 1948, the Egyptian declaration of war in the Egyptian parliament is a declaration of war against us for being communists. The Soviets are arming us in 1948. We're under an American arms embargo in 1948. Yes. Truman recognized Israel, but then didn't give it the guns to fight the war. And so Stalin gives the order directly from Stalin to the Czechs to supply weapons. And there are all these kibbutzim, and the kibbutzim are the elites. And you have all these, the Socialist Party, Mapai, is in power. And so the Egyptian prime minister in the Egyptian parliament, gives the argument for declaring war against the new state of Israel. And he says it is this, he talks about the kibbutzim. He says it's this communist plant in the region. And so the official declaration of war includes the sentence that it's a declaration of war against atheism and nihilism, by which they mean communism. 6 years, 8 years later, by the 56 war, the Soviets have built the Egyptians their new army. There's the pivot is immediate. But in 48, we're Soviet satellite.
And if we pivot now to 2024, they see us as being the long arm of...
In one sentence, the rest of the narrative is we then have an alliance with the French, which supplies us with our weapons right up until basically after the 67 war. And then beginning in 1970, a very close and long-standing alliance with the United States. And for them, until today...
So what is the core misunderstanding then that unleashed October 7th?
So it has multiple layers. But the first layer is that we are something... We are an artificial implant from elsewhere by nefarious outside forces that are very, very powerful. The British Empire, the Tsarist Empire, the German Empire, the American Empire, the French Empire, we are part of colonialism. We are part of imperialism. We are a project of these foreign powers. And you can see it because there's never not been a relationship between Zionism and various forces in the world. Now, the tragedy here is that there is a strategy that flows from that analysis of us. If I actually am an American plant of a little colonialist project here, well, we know how to get rid of colonialist projects. How do we get rid of colonialist projects? We get rid of them the way the National Liberation Front of Algeria got rid of the French Algeria, got rid of the French European colonization of Algeria.
Total violence, including against civilians, put unrelenting pressure until they pack up and the Pieds Noirs leave.
And then the Pieds Noirs leave. And so that was in 1962, the FLN of Algeria kick out the French in that way. Whole cities empty out. I mean, a million people get on a boat. And within 18 months, the Palestinians found the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization.
Directly inspired by the Algerian resistance against the French.
And it's a deep connection to the point where Yasser Arafat, who quickly takes control of the PLO shortly after its founding, gives a speech at the UN General Assembly in 1974, famous speech, which argues that Zionism is in fact colonialism. And he is introduced to the podium by the president of the General Assembly at the time, who is the president of Algeria. In 1988, when Yasser Arafat gets up to declare independence, a national independent state of Palestine, he does it in Algiers. And all of that is a message from deep within this Palestinian national movement that in the 60s becomes modeled on the FLN, that we are going to kick out the Jews the way...
And that's fascinating because I remember watching one of the interviews with a Hamas leader immediately after October 7th, where he speaks about, you know, no nation will be, you know, liberated without sacrifices and martyrs. And he invokes specifically Algeria and Vietnam, that conception that the Jews are somehow this foreign implant. And, right. You know, if you buy into the Palestinian narrative about Israel being this artificial implant in the Middle East, their strategy makes a lot of sense because colonial movements have ended in one of two ways, okay? Either incredible violent pressure on the colonists to get up and leave, as in Algeria, or the end of the colonial movements that led to modern-day Australia, United States, Canada. So natives were effectively wiped out, and that is what they fear that we are trying to do to them. And so I wonder, given the nature of this misunderstanding and how much misery it has brought them by failing to understand what Israel is really about and clinging to this false paradigm that has trapped us in this recurring conflict, why do you think they cling to this narrative instead of saying, okay, clearly we've misunderstood the Israelis, let's course correct and move on?
That's a fundamental question. It is absolutely crucial for me that when we ask, why do Palestinians see us in ways that are so patently not what we are, not our historical experience in the most basic sense, that we do it with tremendous empathy, not sympathy, but just literally the steel man, the argument. In other words, why does it make sense to them? They are thoughtful, serious, intelligent people who know us as well. Well, they probably know us as well as we know them, which is to say not that well, but they're not stupid about it. There is in their history a reason, a good, deep, profound reason. why would they think of us as something that can be essentially willed away through sheer willpower and resilience? First of all, there are those models, French Algeria, and there are several other models that they've used. French Algeria comes in the 60s. The first time we hear them talking about colonialism is already in the 30s. In other words, it's already a serious intellectual point. Imperialism is even earlier with the British and with the Germans. And so there's this discourse that says that we are something foreign that came in. But at each step, if you really listen to the Palestinian discussion of their own history and teaching of their own history, it feels that way in a profound way. I'll give you an example. The Great Arab Revolt of 36 to 39. In 1920 is the first Palestinian Arab massacre of Jews, mm-hmm. organized around a religious idea, around a threat to Al-Aqsa by Haji Amin al-Husseini, a figure who looms large in this whole creation of this Palestinian vision of us in these terms. And then again in 1929. And then by 36 is really a hinge of history for the Palestinians, because there you have a religious cleric. We can get back to religion. It's fundamental to this story. But there you have a cleric named Izzaddin al-Qassam. In his name, Hamas named its military brigades. Izzaddin al-Qassam begins a highest kind of discourse about how we get rid of the Jews, and a very Islamic-focused discourse about how we get rid of the Jews, but it's fundamentally an anti-colonial discourse. And he sparks massacres of Jews and rioting and violence the last 3 years, and it's called the Arab Revolt. Palestinians almost have no books written in Arabic about this event. And it's a fascinating event because, and they don't want to talk about it, but it's a fascinating event because it's the moment in which the Palestinians declare a war on the British Empire out of this vision that Zionism is an arm of the British Empire, and lacking the British Empire will collapse. It is identical to the Palestinians who today tell us, to our faces, routinely, that if the Americans stopped supporting us, we'd collapse. And so they actually declare that war on the British Empire. The British surge forces, as they call it now in America, surge forces to Palestine to deal with this rebellion against the empire. They crush the revolt, sometimes rather brutally. Probably, I have to look up the number, but something in the order of 10% of military age, fighting age men are either expelled or killed.
10%?
In the Palestinian population. They are disarmed to a significant extent. And that leaves them a population reeling when 1948 comes around. 1948 is really two wars. It's the period we call the Civil War, which is 47-48.
Immediately after the UN General Assembly resolution.
Right, when the Arabs and
until the
Jews,
Declaration of Independence.
Right, exactly. Are fighting on the ground. Yeah. And then after May 48...
The international invasion of the Arab
The invasion.
Arabs.
That first half, Palestinian Arab society can't really mount a serious offensive against the Jews because they'd spent themselves...
Because they're still reeling from having made that tragic misunderstanding in 36.
The British, meanwhile, because they're dealing with this very serious revolt, the Jews are clinging to the British. The Jews basically have no militias. They basically have no weapons. And so the British build Jewish militias in 36 to 39. And so the Jews emerge from the Great Revolt in 39 with a full-fledged Haganah, with a full-fledged crack forces of one kind or another, and various militias and various capacities to actually engage in a war. Be Palestinian watching those 3 years. You launch this rebellion against the British. The British disarm you, arm the Jews for the first time in a serious way. Then you reach 1948. Well, of course you're going to lose 1948. You were just disarmed a decade earlier by the British Empire.
And yet... They still launched 48.
And they still launched 48. Not only did they still launch 48, they completely ignore in that history that in 39, the British crushed the revolt. The British then immediately turned to the Arab side and decide Zionism is a net loss for the empire, a net...
Backtrack on the white paper.
The white paper, and Jews are forbidden from going to Palestine when they already can't go to America or Canada or Britain or France or Argentina or Brazil.
And essentially close the gates not only of... the promised land, but of the whole world, the Jews who are fleeing the Holocaust.
The Jews, by British imperial policy in 39, are essentially herded into the gas chambers. The British in 39 don't know about the gas chambers, but when they do know about the gas chambers, and when they know about the gas chambers after the war, they still don't take in the DPs and the DP camps for years. So the British policy in Jewish memory enables the Holocaust.
And anyone visiting modern-day Tel Aviv can visit Gan London opposite Bogoshev Beach, which was erected as a garden in to salute the British bravery during the Blitz, but now hosts a memorial to all the Jews who drowned at sea because the gates of the Land of Israel were closed before, right, during, and immediately after the Holocaust.
Right. So the Jewish memory is that memory of Europe being uninhabitable, of us needing that refuge. The Palestinian memory is, what are you guys talking about? The British gave to you something that wasn't theirs to give to you. The details of the history allow you to form both narratives. The problem isn't that their history of us, their interpretation of us, is wrong. I don't know what the interpretation of history is wrong means. The problem is that if you conclude from that, that therefore we are in some sense that matters strategically, an arm of British imperialism, you will use tactics, anti-imperialist tactics against us that won't work, because we in fact experience that entire story as desperate fragility, vulnerability, and a lesson to always be strong and have no place to go back to. We have no France like the Pied Noir had. We have no Britain to go back to, whether or not there are imperial patron or not. And so they've developed this narrative of what we are, and that's one track. And they have a long history, which isn't, you know, there's a little bit of pseudo-intellectualism in the Palestinian intellectual class. A lot of, excuse me, Rashid Khalidis, he's not here to defend himself, but I'll allow it. All these professors who have tried to write this very one-sided history, they say to correct for other people's one-sided history, but it's not serious history in the sense that it leaves out the other half of the story. But they have tried to create this story that says the Palestinian story is the only version that's real. The problem is that the Jewish experience being the opposite means that any strategy that flows from this Palestinian narrative is going to fail, and it has failed, and they don't know why.
And it's fascinating that you talk about the way that the Palestinians have developed this narrative about who we are based on misreading, although not in the most ridiculous way, events happening here on the ground. But, you know, to borrow a phrase from the UN Secretary General, their narrative wasn't born in a vacuum. There is this global anti-Zionist, anti-Israel movement that is evolving at the same time. I'm wondering how you see those narratives feeding into each other. I mean, who is getting nurtured by whom? Are the Palestinians being nourished by what is being said in radical circles in Europe and the United States? Is the narrative flowing in one direction?
That's a question that's so vast and complex, it's almost impossible to tackle.
Let's have a go.
We'll have a go. I suspect that there is my experience with Palestinian society, and I've tried to get as much experience as I can, is that there's a thin veneer of elites who are who discourse very closely with Western ideological discourses of that kind, very influenced by it, try constantly for decades in various ways to take the Palestinian experience, frame it in Western elite discourse terms, as a way of mobilizing elite public opinion and of belonging to that global
elite.
And
how genuinely is that connected to the narrative?
But I think that that's a shallow thing for Palestinians writ large. I think Palestinians, ordinary Palestinians, most Palestinians, including ultimately the elites, are much more plugged into Muslim world discourse and Muslim world impulses and ideas and ways of framing the Jews than that Western stuff, which is what all the journalists in the West sort of are keyed into. Mm. You will always find that English language Palestinian spokesperson who knows how to speak in sort of campus lingo about Palestinians and drive that agenda and that framing. But ordinary Palestinians are attuned to Arabic language and to Muslim world issues and problems and questions.
And so if we're talking about campus lingo, when you see this huge eruption of anti-Israel sentiment around the world, a lot of jubilation triggered by the October 7 massacre, what are they getting wrong about us? Are they telling the same false narratives that the Palestinians are telling, or is there a different Western dimension that these people on Harvard, these campuses, just don't get about us?
Every single word I've ever heard from all of those protests and speeches and campuses, it's all out of, you know, that thin veneer of Palestinian elite speaking English speak, culturally English, not just the language English. And it's all the old Palestinian misinterpretation. It is just literally 1960. They all read Franz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. He's a doctor who volunteers with the FLN in Algeria, frames the decolonization discourse in a particular way, and that really expands decolonization as a discourse in Western academia and the Western left. And they're all spouting that stuff. In other words, it's not even interesting.
It's fascinating then that Israel has become this sort of bogeyman of the decolonization movement. And Palestinians, Hamas, have become idols of the decolonization movement. Because one of the points that I make that really gets under the skins of a lot of these people is that Zionism is perhaps the most successful anti-colonial movement in the world. The Jewish people are the only people who are able to rise up out of the rubble of empire and claim sovereign dignity and equality and independence in their ancestral homeland. We should be the poster boys of the decolonization movement, and they don't see it that way. And I wonder, why do you think that point really gets under their skins, and why can they not connect to that narrative?
Good question. Zionism is, modern political Zionism is born in Europe. Modern political Zionism used anything it could grab hold of. Mm. It used empires, it used friends, it used enemies sometimes.
And one of my favorite anecdotes on that, you know, you say the Palestinians see the Zionists as being these imperial imperialists, is that at the first Zionist Congress, all the shtetl Jews who arrived in Basel for the first Zionist Congress, Herzl told them all to wear
suits.
Full white tie, because he said, we need to fake it till we make it and convince these Europeans and the aristocrats and the nobility that we're from them and we mean business and we need to convince them to take us seriously. And that was so successful that they managed to trick the Palestinians as well into believing the same bluff.
They managed to, I think, trick later Palestinian intellectuals into thinking of them that way, because also it's convenient to think about them that way. But look, it's if you're Palestinian, okay, and you are watching the Zionist immigration, what do you hope the Zionists are? What would be the most useful thing for them to be?
The sort of thing that might, one day, under enough pressure, pack up and leave.
Pack up and leave. What if they are actually a nation of refugees? Hmm. And what if, as the numbers tick up, their actual plight is more and more desperate? And what if the world has closed its doors? In 1921, America passes the Emergency Quota Act. I think 110,000, 120,000 Jews land in New York Harbor that single year. And I think about 1,000 a year, maybe, are coming to the land of Israel. 95% of the Jews, of the 3 million or so Jews who leave Europe between 1880 and 1920,
other
go to the West.
Yep.
And 5%, less than 5%, I don't think it hits 2%. There's a good estimate of about 50,000. Some people
but
say
it was
maybe
a good investment
as high as 80,
for those who did.
It was a good investment. They got real estate in Tel Aviv. But But it's this tiny, tiny
fraction.
Real
estate in Manhattan is not too shabby either.
They have this tiny, tiny fraction come here, and then it ticks up. Now, in 1935 alone, 65,000 German Jews land here, speaking German. Well, I'll give you a hint why, right? They're fleeing Nazism. And so the Jews are getting more and more desperate. Those Jews in 1920, why does the U.S. Congress pass the Emergency Quota Act? Starting to massively rein in Jewish entry, and 1924, an even stricter quota act, to the point where it goes from 100 and something thousand down to about 3,000 a year. It does so because of the Russian Civil War. The Russian Civil War from 1918 to 21, after the Bolshevik Revolution, is a three-way war in which just about every one of the armies in that war, the White Russians, the Red Russians, the Ukrainian nationalists, massacre Jews en masse when they come across the villages of Jews. And so there are estimates that go as high as 150,000 Jews killed in those 3 years. Europe is becoming less and less tolerant. We, by the way, we Jews have completely forgotten this history.
Because it's been so overshadowed by the so much greater tragedies and trauma that came in just the years after it.
Right. And so they don't see that history because we don't talk about it. We talk about that immigration as this idealistic immigration, nationalist immigration. That they're all also refugees.
Because we put a positive gloss on what was Jewish people fleeing for their lives.
Absolutely. And that's how those immigrants talked about themselves once they got here. But they would not have come if they were not refugees. And so we don't have that. They don't hear us saying what our real story is.
Habib, when we think about the day after Hamas, and I wish it were next week, unfortunately, this is going to take time. One of the things we're talking about is de-radicalization, the need to make sure that the next generation in Gaza are not brought up on a diet of jihad and martyrdom. And part of that de-radicalization is going to have to be fixing the pernicious and dangerous narratives that they've been telling, that have been fueling this conflict. Do you see any prospect for challenging this underlying narrative and making the Palestinians perhaps see us in a different light?
Hamas is everything that we've said until now is true of Hamas. But Hamas adds another layer that isn't true of the more nationalist layers, and that's the religious layer. And if you can't answer the religious layer, you can't de-radicalize Gaza. And the religious layer...
Because they're not thinking in the secular terms and frames of reference.
They have a much longer arc of history, and they have another problem that others don't have. If you're not thinking in the religious layer, I'm trying to think of how to take a very big thing and say it very briefly. For the last century and a half, a great number of Muslim intellectuals and thinkers have been asking this massive, overpowering question. What in God's name happened to us? Why does Islam look the way it looks now? Islam was the height of power, the height of prosperity, the height of science. And then 400 years later, it lags behind everybody. What happened? And they answer that question in many different ways. And some of these answers actually talk about Western institutions, the modern state established at Westphalia, things like that. If we have those things, we will get our mojo back. And that produces Arab nationalist movements, or at least the intellectual underpinnings of them, for example. But there's an entire branch of answers to that huge, enormous question that says that what happened to us was that we have grown far from our God and far from our God's plan. One of the founding ideas of Islam, because the earliest Muslim experience is this unbelievable, astonishing expansion. Muhammad in his lifetime, the Prophet himself, is a conquering emperor. And Muslims didn't know how to explain their own massive military success. And so there is a discourse...
Other than an appeal to the divine.
Yes. It's one of the proofs in Muslim history and discourse. There are more spiritual proofs. There are proofs about the poetry of the Quran being too beautiful to not be divine. There's other ways of talking about it. By the way, this kind of how we prove our religion, it's very common in medieval Judaism and in medieval Christianity. In Islam, one of the great proofs is that conquest, that worldly power, is a reflection of that closeness to God's plan for history, of how much we and God fit each other. And if that's true, then what does weakness mean? What does weakness in politics, weakness economically, weakness in scientific development, what does that say about us? It says about us at the most fundamental level, we and our God are not close. We are not intimately connected to God's plan. Divine grace is not upon us because of something we're doing wrong.
And therefore, the success of Israel induces a very deep religious crisis of faith, you're saying?
It is a theological problem. It creates an impulse to a kind of pre-modern piety that seeks a return into God's grace, which will solve our geopolitical problem. The problem of Israel is both that Islam is shown to be weak facing Israel in a way that it's not shown to be weak facing the great empires. Mm-hmm. So one of the great examples I like to use, both because he is one of the great intellectual founders of Salafi Islam, of this kind of idea and movement within Sunni Islam, is a theologian named Rashid Rida, who lived in Cairo at the end of the 19th century. He's originally from Beirut, which means that part of the Palestinian question is absolutely in his mind. And in 1898, he founds this important journal, very influential journal called Al-Manar in Cairo. And he is writing in response to the First Zionist Congress of 1897, which he followed closely. And he writes a letter to the Arabs of Palestine. And in that letter, he says to them, he starts off the letter, "You complacent nothings." "You will allow," I'm paraphrasing poorly, but people can look this up, it's a well-known quote, "you will allow the impoverished nothings of the world, the most despised people being kicked out and made refugees from every corner and every nation, you will allow them to push you back." Rashid Rida's problem, he's living under British imperialism. Britain controls Egypt in his day.
And but, so the fact that they are then getting defeated by people who are the world's ultimate refugees must be a source of profound offense and hurt.
Yes, and it's not simple shame. It's not just embarrassment. It is a real theological problem. For the British Empire, to rule over some Muslims for some period is not a disaster at the moment of its peak power. But for these 1898 Jews are absolute
refugees.
Who under
the realm of Islam, they're not only experiencing them as Jewish refugees, they're experiencing them as people who had always been protected subjects, dhimmis under the rule of Islam. That was their rightful place in
that,
the social
that is,
order.
I think that is in there. But let's steelman it. Let's say, no, that's not his problem. His problem simply is, if I'm testing Islam's theological closeness to God by the test of worldly power, which is an old Muslim tradition and exists within Muslim discourse and basic sort of Muslim religious impulses, because it's also a converting religion. So how it spreads around the world tells you how it's doing theologically, which is something we Jews don't have, but Christians certainly have it. And even at that steelmanning sort of, let's respect them as, you know, absolutely to the end. The problem of the Jews is a real theological problem. If Jewish refugees, literally the refuse of Europe, that Europe is spitting out in every direction, who just barely can't even find a place to rest their heads, if that's who pushes you back, how far from God is Islam today?
And therefore, to solve the theological problem, you have to deny that they are refugees and the refuse of European society, because confronting that reality...
And therefore, they always have a patron, and they're always the arm of a larger empire.
Haviv,
but not just that. If you go now to Hamas, and you go now to Iran, their problem with us is not just geopolitical. Their problem with us is not just that we need to be destroyed for Islam to return into history as a conquering force, because Islam as a conquering force is an Islam that is theologically justified. Their problem with us is that we can't be destroyed by them. If we could be destroyed by them, if we live at their pleasure, we wouldn't have to be destroyed by them. The problem, the theological problem, is that they can't do it. And that's Islam at its weakest and most distant from God, and therefore we must. They can't compromise on us. We are the beginning of the destruction. Do they actually have to destroy America, the great Satan? No, it's a gigantic, powerful empire. But if they can't even destroy us, they can't show that they and their God are not together and close to each other.
This has been a fascinating discussion. As a spokesman, I'm always trying to help people understand us and understand our story. And here you are explaining how, in fact, the true story of what the Jewish people have been through and the creation of the state of Israel is not enough to simply tell the truth, because it is precisely that truth, precisely the real story, that is so painful and therefore fueling further conflict, because conflict is in some ways a try to evade that truth and avoid confronting those difficult truths. However, yet we are seeing the trend within the Middle East has been towards normalization with Israel. The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, we hope, have been shifting towards making that great reconciliation with Israel. Why are they able to do it?
To my view, this is why at the beginning of the Abraham Accords, I thought, well, you know, we have an enemy, they have an enemy, it's the same enemy, let's be friends. But then the Emiratis didn't just make normalization with us, they actually made peace and invited Israelis and respected Israelis and wanted Israelis and the world to see that they have a deep respect for Israel. And I have begun to talk to people involved in this peace with the Emiratis, including Emiratis. And the sense that we're getting is that there's something very profound happening here. And it's not about Israel. Absolutely, they want Israel as an ally against Iran. Israel's eager for them to be an ally against Iran.
Sometimes these shifts that are happening around us don't necessarily have anything to do with us.
It's a deep religious argument with the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Bahrainis and the conservative Sunni governments generally, the Jordanians, the Moroccans. They are vastly more scared of this vision of Islam as dependent on real world geopolitical triumph. They're more scared of that radicalism than they are of anything we represent. They think, to put it crudely, an Islam that measures its closeness to God and theological justification by whether or not it can eradicate the Jews is the most pathetic and weak version of Islam there can be. Mm. And it is the destabilizing Islam. It is an Islam Iranian proxies everywhere they go basically demolish their own societies long before they hurt us.
And which has been the curse of anti-Semitism throughout history, which has been to devour the societies that host it.
And so this is about us. It's absolutely a war between us and Iran and everything that Iran tries to do in the region and how it empowered Hamas for October 7th. But this is at a profound level, at the de-radicalization level. This is about a war for what Islam means and how Islam comes into its own and becomes a more serious agent in history again and takes its place, gets its mojo back. How do you de-radicalize Gaza? One of the reasons I'm optimistic about the future of Gaza, even though everything now looks catastrophically bleak.
Please, let's find some light at the end of that tunnel.
When the Saudis and the Emiratis let it be known, sometimes implicitly, sometimes leaked to the press, sometimes publicly in interviews with the BBC, that they want to be part of the day after, that they want to be part of the rebuilding. I don't know how to de-radicalize Palestinians. I don't know how to come to Palestinians and say, hey, this idea you have of me, please stop having that idea. I don't know how to do that. They do. The Saudis, since 9/11, for 20 years, have been working hard on pushing back in the bigger theological and cultural war within the Muslim world against this version of Islam, which to their mind is itself the collapse of Islam, is itself part of Islam's crisis, not the solution. And they want to come into Gaza and help fix that thing about Gaza that will forever destroy Gaza, no matter what happens with this war. If Hamas is still around, Hamas will destroy Gaza again in one way or another.
And that definitely gives reason for optimism to think that it's not that once Hamas goes, suddenly there is a vacuum that nothing can fill. There is, in fact, an alternative vision, an alternative ideology, one that has enjoyed a measure of de-radicalization that might be able to enter the vacuum and shift us in a more peaceful direction.
Inshallah.
Okay. Khaviv Retigor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us. Please subscribe on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll continue having more fascinating discussions getting behind the scenes and between the headlines. Thank you very much.